No.
That's good, because the wire's coming up right now. See ya.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, Independent's coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Beth Deshingen. Coming up on The Wire today...
The drone is just like a tractor, you know, it's just a machine to get jobs and it's all about the sensor underneath the payload it carries. That's what makes the real money.
Drones are taking over from shepherds as farmers can now use the technology to keep track of the herds and crops, as well as spread pesticides. But new regulations came in place 2 weeks ago that might change the future for the new technology. And also on The Wire today...
We wanted the movement to go far and wide, but we didn't know that. We couldn't imagine that it would get this big.
The Sydney Peace Prize is being awarded this Wednesday to the Black Lives Matter Foundation. The jury's decisions comes down to building a powerful movement for racial equality, courageously reigniting a global conversation around state violence and racism. Stay tuned for all of this and more on The Wire.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
It's been a bit of a bumpy night for many in the government, not least the Prime Minister, who had to delay his trip to Israel for the centenary of the last cavalry charge in modern warfare, the light horse taking in Beersheba in World War I. But he has been taking plenty of fire himself from just about all sides. First, over the AWU raids that Senator Michaela Cash's staffer leaked to the media, and then over the devastating High Court decision on dual citizenship that saw him lose his lower house majority and his deputy prime minister in one fell swoop. He must be relieved to fly into the relative calm of the Middle East. Roderick Chambers asked Dr. Peter Chen, senior lecturer in politics at the University of Sydney, just what impact the replacement senators would have on the government's legislative program.
My feeling is that for the Nick Xenophon team, Nick Xenophon has been really critical in holding that together, and parties of the centre have difficulty in using ideology as a guide to hold them together. So I'm not sure who's going to replace Nick Xenophon, and I think that's going to be really important. I do wonder if Xenophon's actually giving up on the federal arena and whether they're actually here to stay. We do have a tendency for parties to kind of come and go at the moment, so they might not actually last following his departure, so that'll be interesting to see, and we might end up with just a bunch of independents there at some point.
And he's had trouble with candidates in the past, hasn't he?
Yeah, a little bit of trouble. He tried to be very selective leading into the Senate race, so he didn't do what One Nation or Palmer United Party did and just sort of find every man and his dog and thus sort of shake the tree and get a lot of really loose units. He was very selective. He ran very few candidates outside of his base in South Australia, and I think that was probably a better outcome.
The Greens have their own problems. Richard Di Natale, in the quiet, dark corridors of Greens leadership discussions, has had his problems in the past. And so the two new candidates that will replace his deputies, really, that were supporters of him, will be crucial, won't they?
They will be. He has not been a particularly effective leader in terms of promoting the Greens, and the Greens' profile has been incredibly reduced, I think, during his period of leadership. There is a potential, I think, for a bit of revitalisation of the national scene if Lee Rhiannon does go, not because necessarily I think Lee Rhiannon has to go, but certainly I think the Lee Rhiannon conflict is an unresolvable tension and somebody has to go, and the most likely candidate ends up being Lee Rhiannon, I think, at the end of the day.
And Fiona Nash, now, she's a big loss, not the least because she was the second senior National Party figure to go, but, of course, she's also a woman in cabinet, which there's not many of.
Yes,
it looks like she'll be replaced by a woman, but the big problem is it's going to be a Liberal woman, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And I think for a number of reasons this is slightly problematic. A lot of people had their eye on Nash. as a real up-and-comer. And certainly when the whole High Court challenge issue started to brew up and Barnaby Joyce was under threat, a lot of people said, well, Nash is actually extremely capable and competent. The transition will be handled well temporarily if he's out of the scene, and Nash is a future national leader. That'll give her a chance to shine, and because she's taken out too, that's kind of not going to eventuate. So I think it is a little bit disappointing because most people would regard her as an extremely competent figure who's lost an opportunity here. So
and there's how will she get back into Parliament? She'll have to wait till next election, won't she?
Possibly so. I think those debates are ongoing, and the question is, will the Nationals, through a variety of both conceding the point on the acting Prime Ministership to Julie Bishop, which we've seen in the last couple of days, and also on the kind of a carrot side of the equation, and also on the stick side of the equation, today they're rattling the cage about how important the Nationals are for the coalition, will they be able to get the Liberals to concede that seat back to the Nationals? And I think that's a kind of interesting thing. It'll tell us a lot about the state of the coalition arrangement based on who gets back in. And I think a wise Liberal Party would concede it back to the Nationals, but they're having difficulty managing themselves, and there'll be obviously internal tensions to placate people by throwing that seat to someone within the Liberals.
And just before we leave the Senate there, Nigel Scullion is the ranking National in Parliament, although he's not technically a National, is he? Is it practical to have a Senator as an acting Prime Minister when the Prime Minister's out of the country?
Well, the Prime Minister's position doesn't really exist in the Constitution. So on a kind of strict basis, does this person need to exist slash sit in the lower house? Basically, the Constitution says, you know, the government will be constructed by the Prime Minister and their cabinet, and then talks more about other things. But by convention, it should be someone in the lower house. I think temporarily, in terms of just fulfilling the functions of, you know, being a de facto head of state, which the Prime Minister has become really, anyone, quote-unquote, can do that role. But I would have said, given all the things that are going on, why add an additional new dimension to the sort of train wreck by getting someone out of the Senate?
And Julie Bishop's a pretty safe choice as the acting Prime Minister anyway, isn't she?
Yeah, and real future leadership potential. So I guess she swaps in for Fiona Nash in that way. You really want someone who looks like they can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Yeah, well, of course, Michaelia Cash was perhaps the next most prominent woman in the government's ranks. There's a lot of calls from the opposition to have for her to fall on her sword. Do you think she will?
No, I don't think so, because of the implications that would have. But, I mean, there is a huge amount of daylight between the, you know, soon-to-be acting Prime Minister and Michaelia Cash in terms of how people regard their competency. She's a real warrior and has a lot of support from her side of the party. But in terms of a number of things that she's had management over, she's not regarded as being as effective. So she will stay, but not because that's a mark of competency. And also, I think at the end of the day, we can say that this concept of ministerial accountability and responsibility is now dead.
Dr. Peter Chen, Senior Lecturer in Politics at the University of Sydney, ending that report by Roderick Chambers.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
I'm Bethy Shingen, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. Summer is the busiest time of the year for aerial agriculture as farmers order pilots to spray crops with pesticides to combat weeds. More and more farmers are looking into using remote-controlled drones to do the job. Will there be a revolution in our skies? Philip Stempion investigates.
They can sound like an angry wasp and are a popular toy for kids and enthusiasts alike. Drones have been used for a range of business uses, including wedding videos and real estate photography. Farmers are now discovering the potential of drones in a range of farm applications such as surveying, scouting and spraying pesticide.
The drone is just like a tractor, you know. It's just a machine to get jobs, and it's all about the sensor underneath the payload it carries. That's what makes the real money.
Dr. Will Bignell is a seventh generation farmer in Tasmania and is one of the 1,000 registered drone pilots around the country. He uses drones for his own family farm as well as for his aerial surveying business. He's also a licensed pilot and says there are many jobs drones can do that would be dangerous for larger planes.
It reduces the danger to people. I mean, that's a good fit for drones, is we're dirty, dangerous jobs. We're great for that. Flying around low, around a paddock with a plane, trying to take a photo under a wing, low and slow, you know, concentrating on your paddocks, that's dangerous. It's a dangerous type of flying. So, you know, you're just reducing risks, whereas you put a UAV up, you know, there's no real danger to any person.
The drone industry is quite well established, and drones can be built for any scenario, including high wind. But sensors designed for agriculture are still highly experimental. Dr. Bignell says remote sensing techniques are still in development, and the first camera dedicated for crop health was only released this year.
If you give poor data to a farmer, or data that isn't true, they can see it straight away, because we live and breathe these crops. We're not idiots. So you send me dud data, I'll spot it, won't trust it, won't believe it, and a heck of a lot of that goes on. But, yeah, now we're getting to the point where we're getting good data. We are bringing up variable rate fertiliser, variable rate irrigation. So, you know, I took a photo last week of my paddock, of wet areas and soil types. I've then gone down a 940-metre irrigator and changed the water rate on every single sprinkler the whole way down it. So down 290 sprinklers. And they turn on and off according to the wetness of the soil. So it allows us to do that sort of stuff. I couldn't have done that on foot before. But, yeah, 1 hour drone flight, half an hour on a computer and upload it to the machine. And, yeah, we're suddenly using water better, reducing water logging and, being more sustainable.
Aerial agriculture, which is commonly known as crop dusting, is a very important part of the industry. In Australia, there are around 300 aerial ag pilots who are represented by the Aerial Agriculture Association of Australia. CEO of the association, Phil Hurst, says drone pilots are more than welcome to join it, but the authorities are lagging behind on regulating the booming sector.
Everyone's struggling to catch up with this fairly new phenomenon that is represented by drones, and consequently the regulations are only just being made now to allow, for example, licensing and use of drones in agriculture.
He says drones have many benefits, but they also must adhere to strict regulations on pesticide use and safety.
The specialty of remotely piloted vehicles is that you use them where it's dirty and dangerous. That's all well and good, but they also have to meet the mark on safety, on protecting the environment, on making sure there's no spray drift, etc. So there's a bunch of parameters there that the drone industry is really struggling to get their head around at the moment.
In 2013, there was a close call between a drone and a crop duster as they flew within 100 metres of each other. It was investigated by the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, and in this particular case, it seemed like a miscommunication was the main issue. Mr. Hurst says CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, needs to address this issue, and he has a suggestion as to how they can deal with it.
The issue of communication is the one risk that CASA have not managed to address in any way, shape or form, which is a bizarre approach to risk management. And we've said in various submissions to Senate inquiries and to CASA inquiries that what really needs to happen is a simple app be made available so that, for example, an established aerial applicator using conventional aircraft could drop a pin on a geographic system like Google Earth or something. And then if any drone operator wants to operate, they also drop a pin to say, here I am, and that would enable the two to communicate by an exchange of phone numbers or something else. And communication is the absolute base condition of good spraying and good aerial application. So if we can get the communication thing happening, then the risks are lowered all around, and that's what's missing at the moment.
CASA has recently released a number of new regulations dealing with drones to ensure everyone uses airspace safely. CASA spokesperson Peter Gibson urges drone users to look at the new rules.
The fines range from around $1,000 to up to more than $10,000. So there can be some serious penalties there for people who break the drone rules. Very important that everyone follows the drone safety rules. Whether you're flying a recreational drone for fun in a park or an open area, or you're using a drone for a commercial purpose in aerial agriculture.
Civil Aviation Safety Authority spokesperson Peter Gibson concluding that report by Philip Sempion.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
The Black Lives Matter Global Foundation will this Wednesday be awarded the Sydney Peace Prize. Co-founder of the organisation, Patrice Cullors, and co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto, are in Sydney to accept the prize on behalf of the organisation. I spoke to Ms. Cullors and asked her to talk a bit about Black Lives Matter.
Yes, Black Lives Matter is a global network, and it was co-founded by myself, Alicia, and Opal in 2013. Our main focus is identifying the impact anti-Black racism has on communities, both inside the U.S. but also across the world, and fighting for the human rights of Black people.
So it started in America, in the U.S. Mm-hmm. How was it that it started?
Well, it started with a Facebook message. Many of us were very disturbed by the acquittal of George Zimmerman in 2013, the man who killed Trayvon Martin. And we went to social media to grieve, to process, to talk to other people, you know, who were also upset about the acquittal. And Alicia Garza actually wrote a note to Black people, and she closed off the note with Black Lives Matter. And I put a hashtag on the note. The very next day, we had a conversation. Said that we wanted to build something out, an online platform. Black people can have conversations about George Zimmerman, but other issues in the Black community as well. And Opal Tometi helped create the infrastructure, the online platforms to help build it out.
We saw all over the world the hashtag Black Lives Matter. It spread pretty quick. Did you expect that type of response when you first started it?
We didn't know what type of response we were going to get. I think we were, you know, we said that we wanted a hashtag and we wanted the movement to go far and wide, but we didn't, you know, we didn't know that, we couldn't imagine that it would get this big.
So reaching all over the world now, also to Australia, do you know anything about how the Black Lives Matter community is down here?
Well, I know we've been able to meet with the community, an Indigenous community, Black communities in Mildura, and we are going to spend our week here in Sydney and then head over to Melbourne. We've been in conversation with lots of different groups and have read about both the history but on what's happening and present day for their Indigenous communities here. So I feel like we have a good sense, but there's nothing like meeting people and really hearing their stories directly.
Mm. So, yeah, like you said, hearing the stories, hearing about what happens, it is clear that there is a need down here as well. And what do you think it then means for the Australian Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander community that your organisation wins this prize and gets this recognition?
Well, I think it means different things. You know, communities are not a monolith, but I think why it's important that Black people are receiving this recognition, especially a younger movement. I think we're probably one of the youngest Sydney Peace Prize winners, is it speaks to a contemporary issue around anti-Black racism and its impacts on communities here in Australia and across the world. I think what's, you know, deeply important about this moment is we're having a global conversation about colonialism, about racism, about white supremacy. And here in Australia, as you know, the Indigenous community is only 2.5% of the population, but makes more than half of those incarcerated and are deeply impacted by deaths in custody. We see that there's a deep connection with the conversations around state violence that are happening globally.
That was Patrice Cullors ending that report. With a scale in hand and blindfolded, Lady Justice is the epitome of equality before the law. But are we all equal before the law? Do we all have access to law and justice at large? This report is the second installment on the topics of access to justice, focusing on the challenges faced by the homeless and Indigenous people. Danielle Slimon reports.
When we think about justice, the first thing that comes to mind is access to the law, a lawyer, or some sort of legal service. Justice, however, is recognising disenfranchisement amongst individuals and groups and remedying those inequities ideally through preventative measures or restorative practices. Perhaps even through what some are calling an emotionally intelligent justice. The Justice Project, undertaken by the Law Council of Australia, is compiling research and stories in the hopes of lobbying the Australian government to take measures to ensure access to justice is better funded and responded to. Homeless people and the Indigenous population both face significant policing pressure, which makes access to justice essential to ensure that they don't continue to face the court system. Yet often it is the law itself that needs to be reassessed in light of a call to justice. Tamara Walsh is Associate Professor of Law at the T.C. Burns School of Law.
Many things that need to change within the law itself. For a start, there are so many criminal offences that directly and sometimes indirectly criminalise the state of homeless. So there's been a lot of attention in the media lately, particularly with the encampments in Sydney and Melbourne around street sweeping type provisions. So these have existed in other jurisdictions for a long time. So they enable police or local government officials to move people who are homeless and who have set up tents or other improvised dwellings on from particular areas. There are move-on powers in every jurisdiction across Australia, but in certain jurisdictions there are also provisions that prevent you from camping in a public space, prevent you from storing belongings in a public space. And these are the kinds of laws that are being proposed in Melbourne and indeed have been passed in Sydney.
There may be some unique differences when it comes to vulnerable people, yet there is a general theme that suggests the criminal law impacts and targets the homeless and Aboriginal people.
I think we can generalise that vulnerable people are certainly more likely to be targeted by the criminal law. They are more likely to have criminal law offences that directly impact upon them. They're also more likely to be caught at the enforcement stage. That is true of people experiencing homelessness. That is true of people who are mentally unwell. It's also true of young people. One of my most recent studies with regard to the public nuisance offence in Queensland is that actually young Aboriginal people are particularly vulnerable to being charged with that offence. Now, that's a catch-all offence that enables police to charge people with almost anything that causes a nuisance to the public.
Aboriginal people are some of the most incarcerated in the world, notwithstanding some positive initiatives and innovations to safeguard their legal rights. Dahlia Anthony is an associate professor at the UTS School of Law.
In terms of the ongoing funding for Aboriginal legal services, there's been some capacity to accommodate the needs of Indigenous people, but generally we've seen legal services, including community legal services, really struggle to get ongoing and secure funding. So it's, you know, compromised their capacity. But notwithstanding that political and funding context, I mean, certainly, you know, if we look at some of the Aboriginal legal services across the country, they've, you know, developed initiatives and new programs that have sought to address needs. You know, we look at what the Aboriginal Legal Service is doing in Bourke in New South Wales around justice reinvestment. If we look at the work of the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency and their work with through care in prisons, we're seeing that there are innovations notwithstanding the constraints they face.
When it comes to dealing with Aboriginal people, there is a mistrust of the police and the legal system, and Aboriginal laws and customs are not given judicial weight.
Whenever we look at access to justice, we have to understand and interrogate why Indigenous people are in the justice system in the first place and whether state interventions need to be challenged rather than just the ways in which the Indigenous population navigates the legal system, how that can be better supported. We've recently seen a rollout of the CopWatch program where Indigenous people in particular are being encouraged to film police activities because they feel there's very little accountability. So this reflects that distrust.
The social dimension of justice cannot be ignored. Access to justice means keeping people away from the courts.
As a result of the austerity measures in the United Kingdom over the last few years, they have been forced to innovate. And what they've shown us is that the most important thing is to keep people out of the court. So in the United Kingdom, what they're doing is making sure that when they encounter people who are vulnerable on the street, rather than charging them with an offence, they are engaging with service providers much more often to try and address the needs of that particular person. So they might call a housing provider to see if there is accommodation available. They might actively take someone to a mental health service if that's what they're in need of. So what they've found in the United Kingdom as a result of cost cutting is that actually the way you cut costs is to provide people with the services they need rather than criminalise them.
Tamara Walsh, Associate Professor of Law at the T.C. Byrne School of Law, ending that report by Danielle Sleeman. That's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, all in one word. The Wire is a team effort by Radio 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia on weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. My name is Bertha Schingen, and thanks for your company.
It's not just about people in barrels, so shut up.
What the hell?
Plenty of interesting banter to offer up right here on 2SER.